Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. One half of all marriages in the United States end in divorce. Many of these couples have children. The legal and psychological aspects of divorce can be overwhelming for all of those involved, particularly children. Our phone numbers are 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. In addition, you can email us at lineone@kska.org. My guests today are clinical psychologist Kathy Von Hippel and attorney Julie Wrigley, both of Anchorage.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome, both of you. Julie, this is your first time, and Kathy says I've done this three times. This is her third time, but I can't remember but one other one, so
yeah.
I'm getting old.
Yeah, it is my first time.
So divorce and children, psychology, effects, and an attorney with us, maybe for the first time. So why are we doing this? What's the purpose? What are we trying to get accomplished today?
Well, in my work as a clinical psychologist and in Julie's work as an attorney, we have both spent a lot of time with families in the process of divorce. And in conversation with each other, we thought that it would probably be a great idea to provide a workshop for families in the divorce process, a workshop that was designed to help people understand important legal principles and psychological principles for how to make this process go as well as possible. There's a lot of legal, emotional, and financial distress that occurs. And children of divorce are disproportionately represented in clinical samples. So we'd like to see if we can help families to negotiate divorce more productively, more constructively, so that they can maintain or reestablish a homeostasis and move on in their lives.
And Julie, before we came on, I kind of got the idea about the psychological aspects of this, but you were bringing up that there's maybe some new options for divorce from a legal standpoint that maybe would help us understand why that's important to talk about as well.
Well, yes, that I am not a family lawyer, which comes as a surprise, I think, to people when they find out that I'm doing this. And I'm actually a estate planning and business lawyer, and was inspired to do this because of the intersection I see between family law and business planning. There's business planning, there's estate planning, and even though this isn't a very well-liked term, there really isn't any divorce planning. And what Kathy and I believe is that with some planning and some education, people can approach this divorce process or this uncoupling, unmarrying of spouses or former partners, as it may be, and do it in a way that's more productive for themselves, financially, emotionally, for their children, and have a better outcome in the long run.
So there's a lot of important legal aspects of this that people are not aware of often when they get into it. And often I'll have to say they're probably not aware of the psychological impact on the children and themselves from this whole issue. So you're trying to bridge both of those areas that are probably not well established or well thought out when this all starts. They're going through the divorce for one reason or the other, but they don't understand the legal and the emotional and psychological aspects. And those are the two big parts of this that you see need to be brought together.
Exactly. I think that, I am the lawyer, not the psychologist, but from a legal perspective, why not plan carefully for what you're stepping into. This is a divorce sets your future. And so by educating yourself, which a lot of people do, but maybe not in this particular way, you can really set yourself up for better success.
Mm-hmm. How about some idea of the topics that you all cover in the workshops? And then let's don't forget to talk about how people can get to the information about the workshops as well.
Okay, well, we talk about basic facts about divorce, what are the statistics of how often divorce occurs, what does it predict in terms of mental health outcomes, et cetera. We talk about the psychology of divorcing parents. Oftentimes, people have difficulties with decision-making and will tend to screen information in such a way that they only accept as relevant information that confirms their perspective and have a hard time seeing the legitimacy of another person's perspective. And obviously, if you're doing that, it makes it really hard to reconcile your perspective to your spouse's and to problem solve solutions together. So we look at the ways people make decisions and how to improve your decision making so that you can proceed and make constructive decisions as you co-parent with your spouse. We look at the legal aspects of divorce, like what's the advantage of dissolution, mediation, collaborative law, or contested divorce. We talk about what are the predictors of positive outcomes in children. So in other words, how do you promote your child's mental health? We talk about practical things like how to tell kids about the divorce. We talk about the developmental stages of reaction to divorce because kids respond to divorce differently based on their age and their temperament. We talk about how to build a visitation schedule, which is also something that's directly related to a child's age and temperament. And we talk about how to aid a child in need because some children will be very resilient and manage the divorce process quite well, and some children will not and will need some help from psychotherapy, from their pediatrician, from their teachers, from their grandparents, from the community at large.
How come judges don't do some of these legal things that we're talking about, like setting up visitation schedules? Why wouldn't we depend on them to do that?
Well, judges are some of the most highly educated, you know, people out there. And fortunately, they're highly educated in the law. And that's why we have psychologists and psychiatrists and educated pediatricians and custody investigators. We have people besides the judges whose job it is to make those recommendations to the judges. Judges would prefer that you come to them with your co-parenting solution to your co-parenting problem. The law is not interested really in telling you how to parent your children. Really, it's trying to set you up for success and the autonomy to decide for yourselves with the parent that you, the other parent, your former spouse, the other parent to this child. You're supposed to make those decisions together. And the law, it does provide defaults when you can't or you can no longer agree on what you should do. But really, that's the judges would prefer not to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it would be better to be done in the format that you're discussing for all involved when it's possible.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's one of the points you're trying to get across. And what's the kind of divorce this is called when you get...
Well, there are a couple different types that we mention. One, they all get you to the same place. They all get you divorced, which is... Or unmarried, as a friend of mine prefers to call it. One is a dissolution, and that's a pretty straightforward process if you all agree. If everyone agrees, then you're just having a legal dissolution, and that's the end of that. Then there's mediation, which is another type of another process. And in a mediation, there's one mediator who is helping the two parties come to an agreement on their solution to unmarry. The newest and, you know, I will endorse as maybe the best, yet untested, but most creative and hopefully the best, is what they call collaborative law. And there's a whole group of lawyers who are educating themselves on this process of collaborative law, and their goal is to have each party represented by a lawyer. And as you know, a lawyer's job is to represent their client to the best of their ability. So they are zealous advocates. So each party is represented by a zealous advocate of themselves, and yet they are still negotiating in a collaborative way a solution to unmarry from each other. So that's called collaborative law. And then everyone, I'm guessing everyone knows about contested divorce. You see it on the TV and hear about it with your neighbors down the street. But a contested divorce is just when everyone has their own lawyer and they aren't attempting a collaborative mediated or you know, already agreed upon.
And the downside on the mediation that you pointed out to me before the program is there's really the mediators there to help you guys, a man and a wife, to decide how to dissolve the marriage without too much expense, I guess. But there really is no overlooking what's best for each of the couple, the man and the woman in that. It's just trying to come to some agreement, whereas with this collaborative divorce, you each have representatives and you're trying to mediate what would be best for both of them financially as well as maybe
psychologically. Exactly, exactly. You know that with collaborative law, you know that someone's out there looking specifically out for you. And mm-hmm. I think that people would find that comforting. I would.
Well, for example, Thad, I've seen many families where after the settlement has occurred, one of the parents regrets it and thinks, I really didn't understand right. what a 401k was, what the value of that was, and I just gave mm-hmm. that away. And actually, it wasn't an equitable settlement, mm-hmm. and now I have hostility about it. And now I'm angry, and it's making it hard for me to focus on co-parenting because I'm livid, and I have financial stress. And so this situation is carried forth into the future of co-parenting. And so it really—
Into the psychology of divorce.
Into the psychology.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
right.
Okay.
That's
All
right.
right.
Hmm. So the idea of having an attorney representing each of the parents in a mediation is that attorney can make sure that the person they're representing is fully informed about all of the financial components of their settlement and is truly giving informed consent.
I was trying to think before I came on. I'm getting ready now to get into the psychology. So I'm getting back to you, Kathy. I wanted to.
You're fine.
I want to get this law issue
yeah,
out of the way. All right. So I was thinking before the show, what's more traumatic? What are the big traumatic things that happen to people during their life? And certainly a death of someone's close is really up there. And then getting sued is one that came to my mind. And I've missed that one and I've missed the divorce. But those are big things.
Yeah.
Are there others that I'm not thinking about? And how would you rank the effect of divorce, given what you've seen in your professional practice and how it affects people?
Well, there's a lot of research about the effects of divorce on children. And what I can tell you is we used to think that kids would get over it. And it might be a rough 6 months or a rough year. A rough patch, but soon enough they'd settle into a new pattern. But there's quite a bit of research, most notably by Judith Wallerstein from University of California, Berkeley, that shows that up to 25 years after the divorce, children of divorce show a less positive outcome mm-hmm. than children with married parents. For example, they're twice as likely to divorce themselves. They're more likely at a statistically significant level to have mood and anxiety disorders. They have some difficulties choosing dependable mates, knowing how to problem solve constructively within a relationship. They also have worse physical health. So on a variety of measures of well-being, children of divorce actually have long-term deleterious consequences. So this is really an issue that affects people lifelong. And one of the interesting things that I like about Wallerstein's research is she discovered that that these adults who are 25 years out from the date of their parents' divorce continue to have their parents' divorce as one of the dominant themes in their life, a dominant issue in their domain of concerns, and which really suggests that this paradigm we have that's comforting to think that the kids will just get over it is really more of a fantasy and not actually true.
Is that true of death of a loved one, for example, a mother or father or a grandparent? Do you know about the long term? I mean, I'm beginning to understand that from what we're knowing about neurophysiology. I mean, we set down brain patterns that, boy, you have some big effect. It's hard to change those. It's hard to change a fear and anxiety over time. So I can understand that. But I'm wondering how that relates to other issues like death. I mean, do we carry that with us a long time, too?
We do, but I think that people have different sorts of responses to death. There's a death, like the death of someone who's elderly and has mm-hmm. been ill, and the death is okay. sort of predicted All is right. one thing. The death yep. of a sudden traumatic accident is another thing,
yep.
and that can have more of a post-traumatic stress reaction. So people have very different responses based on the nature of that trauma. But really the question is divorce sort of a trauma? The answer is yes. That's what the research indicates, is that the experience of divorce is very traumatic for kids.
Let me remind our listeners, if you've got questions or comments today about the effects of divorce on all involved, give us a call. 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us during this next hour at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. What about the effects that you've just outlined, the long-term effects that are on children, 25 years out in studies that are documented? We still carry some of that baggage, if I can use that too much of a used term. But what about how that is varies per age of the child at the time of divorce? What do we know about differences in age at the time and how they carry that?
That's a great question. Well, children respond differently based on their developmental stage. Very young children, preschoolers, often have difficulty understanding what's going on and may take a little longer to process. If you think of primary school age kids are more inclined to climb into the conflict, to climb into the fray. And so they may be more inclined to triangulate into conflicts with their parents, or to act as a messenger, or to, in some ways and certainly unconsciously, to perpetuate conflict between the parents and contribute to discord in the home. High school students are generally focused on how is this divorce going to affect them? What kind of inconvenience is this going to involve? And it can include, how are resources going to be limited? You know, when kids come in who are in high school and their parents are divorcing, they can reasonably expect that there may not be money for college, or that the quality of life, the things that their family was able to afford, is going to change. And as you know, high school kids certainly have feelings about cell phones and opportunities to have things. So they can have feelings about that, plus feelings of discomfort when their parents start dating and they're sort of confronted with the sexuality of their parents, which is really an uncomfortable topic, particularly at that age.
Uh-huh. So there really are, well, because of the development of children over time, there's different ways they manifest themselves, different things affect them. And I didn't think about the sexuality aspect and the adolescent thinking about themselves. I keep thinking about kids, and I guess I'm thinking about the school-age kid who's getting torn between two parents I'm thinking of trying to please both parents and getting themselves into trouble. And you mentioned that, only that, it may even worsen things because they're trying to do that.
Right. And there's this idea in psychology called resilience. And resilience basically is your ability to bounce back from adversity. And some people some children are just resilient in nature. They're born that way. But it turns out that resilience isn't just a temperament that we're born with. It's something we can teach kids to do. Hmm. And so so there are things like people who are resilient make a lot of social connections. They tend to avoid seeing crises as insurmountable. They see change as part of living. They move towards goals. They take decisive action. So there's a lot of different positive qualities associated with resilience. Kids who are resilient do better when their parents are divorcing, and children who are not resilient, whose parents are divorcing, can benefit from psychotherapy to learn how to be resilient, as can their parents benefit from learning how to teach their kids to be resilient.
I love the concept of temperament, so I hate it when you destroy it like that. But
sorry,
what you're
that.
Basically but what I what I think I'm hearing is back to cognitive behavioral therapy to these kids to teach them what some kids who are more resilient already have because of temperament. No.
Right. Right. Sure.
So what is cognitive behavioral therapy, and how does that relate to what you just said you're doing
okay,
to these
well,
kids?
Cognitive behavioral therapy is the idea of cognitive therapy is that we can have cognitions that are wrong. So you can have thoughts that are wrong. So at the most simple level, think of it this way. If I gave you a bunch of math to do, mm-hmm. you'd probably make a couple mistakes. I ask you 100 questions. Maybe you'll make a mistake. And I can say, that is a mistake, Thad, right there. Just so when you're making emotional decisions, we all tend to make some mistakes. And so what cognitive therapy says is, let's look at our thinking assumptions and see where we're making illogical and unhealthy conclusions. So an example would be, if I fail this math test, then I'm an idiot. Or if I fail this math test, I'll fail the whole math course. That's really catastrophic thinking. It might actually mean that I need to work on these specific skill set. It doesn't follow that my personhood is horrible, mm-hmm. Or my future is going to be negative. So cognitive behavioral approaches look at changing your cognitions and then changing your behaviors. Because if you can identify the ways that you're thinking illogically, then you can identify more constructive ways to behave.
Yeah, and I was just thinking while you were talking about this, some of those ways you're thinking are maybe innate and in your genes to some degree, and some are environmental. I mean, some people are thinking what they're trying to do is please somebody on the other side, whereas other things might be more – I mean, some people are more persistent and they may struggle and work harder at something. It gets pretty complex is the way I think about it.
Right. So if you have a child who has a highly anxious temperament, it's really important that the adults in their life help them to articulate healthy ways to think mm-hmm. and to cope with problems that arise mm-hmm. because it doesn't come to that anxious person inferentially. It doesn't come naturally to them.
I mean, as a lawyer, you must see differences in your ability to deal with different clients and see these issues. Does it help you to work with a psychologist to help deal with the individual needs of clients, too?
Oh, well, I think absolutely. I mean, who can't use psychology in their daily life, no matter what your profession is? I think insight into human behavior and the appreciation that, you know, your view of handling a situation is not the same as everyone else is incredibly helpful.
One of the questions that Julie and I are often asked is, gee, there's a lot of risk to divorce, so maybe we should just skip it entirely. Is divorce just flatly a bad idea? And that's really an interesting question. Despite the risk, is divorce sometimes better for all involved? Is really what it boils down to. And the reality is that the biggest problem isn't the divorce. It's interparental conflict. And whenever you have a lot of interparental conflict, so brawling, angry, hostile parents in perpetual conflict, that is a strong predictor for negative adjustment in kids. So if a family can achieve less conflict through divorce, then maybe they want to consider it. If they can't, then they need to take that into account.
I just got an email. I was distracted as that happens with these emails. But this comes it was related to the collaborative law divorce practice. And I won't give the emailer's name, but Julie, I just mentioned that the guest emailer says, regarding today's guest mention of collaborative divorce, I offered the following information on the collaborative group in Alaska.
Oh, yes. Must be one of the members.
Yeah, the Alaska Collaborative Practice Group does not just include lawyers, but also financial professionals.
Yes, that is absolutely
and psychologists.
It's a very complicated, it's a very broad practice in that ultimately there's a lot of different variations. I guess it's not just lawyers. It can be financial planners are incredibly helpful, as are psychologists, and one of the great things about collaborative law is that it is kind of a practice session for how maybe you will negotiate the future conflicts that come up between the divorcing parties as life evolves. The divorce is just the beginning, and in collaborative law, all of these parties are sitting down, the financial planners, and they're all giving insight, and these divorcing spouses are having to work through these problems together. In fact, one of the questions when I went through the training for the collaborative law, one of the questions that came up from one of the participants was, well, how many times do you see people actually decide, well, forget it, we've helped us work through our problems and we're not going to get divorced anymore because mm-hmm. this is mimicked a psychological session or, you know.
Right.
And from all the collaborative lawyers that I've talked to, and the answer to the question in the training was that not very often, that people still get divorced.
I was hoping you were going to say something.
I know. Wouldn't it be nice if,
okay.
if it was that? Cause I'm not saying collaborative law can fix, you know, marriages that in the verge of collapse. But what it can do, it seems to me, there's a great potential anyway for these parties to realize that they are still a family. You can have that piece of paper that says you are now unmarried. I now pronounce you, you know, single person, single person. However, it puts right in your face that, you know, let's work this out. The problems don't end here, especially if you're the younger the kids are, the more life stages you have yet to encounter. And how you negotiate that conflict, you know, as Kathy has discussed, is huge. So...
There's a couple of links to the organization here, and we'll put them up on our website. And by the way, those who are listening, you can get the website for Julie and Kathy's programs, their educational system from our website as well. It's called RiptideDivorceEducation.com. But there is a link on our website. What are the most common reasons for divorce? Is that a fair question, or is there as many as there are people out there?
Well,
or are there something things keep coming up over and over again?
Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons for divorce. It's infidelity, of course, is a common one. Abuse is a common one.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional, physical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Physical abuse. People become less connected. Their communication breaks down over time. That can be a problem. Some people just have a very unrealistic expectation of what's going to happen in a marriage, and they become disappointed that their partner can't meet all their life needs. Financial stress is a big one. So infidelity, communication breakdown, abuse, financial stress, negativity. Those are the big ones.
Seems like I hear certainly about infidelity and abuse as a pediatrician. I hate to maybe say that. Those are two that would seem to come up most commonly. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason I drove the question. So it may depend a little bit on the age of the couple?
Yeah, it could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. We're going to take a short break, and afterwards we'll continue to take any emails or calls that you might have with Dr. Kathy Von Hippel and Julie Wrigley on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. Today we're speaking with Dr. Kathy Von Hippel, a clinical psychologist here in Anchorage, and a local attorney, Julie Wrigley. They've started their own educational divorce education website and a group of courses designed to help people work through all the issues involved with divorce, both psychological and legal. So if you've got questions or comments, you email us at line1@kska.org and give us a call, 550-8433. Also, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a pre-recorded program, and we wouldn't be available to answer your questions. Kathy, let's get back to the effects on children. So what are specific effects on children of divorce?
Well, in the short term, while parents are in the throes of the divorce process, typically there's a lot of emotional unavailability. Parents are very busy with legal proceedings plus working full time, and children will commonly complain that their parents are on the cell phone or on their computer all the time communicating about their legal issues. So the child will often feels really emotionally abandoned by both parents, especially if you consider that they'll start often a visitation cycle where they're just with one parent. And then if that parent's preoccupied, then there's no one else available to absorb the child's needs. There's quite frequently a dramatic decrease in economic comfort. So kids will complain that the family can no longer afford the dance lessons and the activities they used to do. And it's not just the child's not getting these things, but if the child isn't participating in activities they used to participate in, then they don't get to see those friends, participate in the social network that was supporting them in the community. There's an increase in mental health problems. Anxiety is certainly florid among children of divorce. And so some kids articulate worries, but other ways you can observe anxiety. Typical things are stomach aches, headaches, problems falling asleep, problems staying asleep, lack of appetite. So there's some physical manifestations. Depression. Certainly we all identify sadness, but often kids will present with irritability where an adult might wonder, is this child sad or are they just obnoxious? And all kids are obnoxious sometimes, so maybe I don't need to take him to the pediatrician because he's just in a rough stage right now. Oppositionality can happen too, where kids say essentially like, I reject your authority. You seem to have failed mother or father as a parent. If you failed your marriage, you're not managing very competently, so I'm not going to listen to you. So there's quite a bit of immediate emotional response to the divorce. And then as the further you go out, some of those issues can resolve. Some of the emotional issues, the volume on it will turn down. But there's still sort of life larger questions that children will pose, like how do you resolve conflicts and how do I communicate effectively and how do I assert my needs when I need something? What do I do? So those effects continue.
It sounds like also there could be the risk of misdiagnosis of kids when they are going through some of these stressful situations.
Right. There's something called an adjustment disorder. So mm-hmm. We have different diagnostic categories for mental health problems. An adjustment disorder means that basically you're having a rough time adjusting to something to a situation that came up in your life. And usually an adjustment disorder is a fairly benign diagnosis. It means that you're going to get over it soon. Mm-hmm. Some kids do get better spontaneously and with some support, and that's great. And some kids maintain their anxiety over time, and then it's a full-blown anxiety disorder, and that's certainly disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess I was trying to get in, and I may not have done it well, that kids could be misdiagnosed as depressed or oppositionally defiant during periods of this adjustment.
Sure, absolutely.
Because you may not be taking enough history to really understanding what's going on with the child. I can see the pediatricians doing that, maybe your physicians more than the psychologist. But
well, and a place you might really see that is in school, where mm-hmm. Often kids will misbehave.
Good point.
And a teacher might just think that this is not such an awesome kid, especially if that teacher only has him for one period. And what they don't know is the larger context of all this family disruption. And if they knew the larger context, certainly the teacher and all the educators would be much more sympathetic and supportive. But sometimes they don't have that information.
Okay. Kenneth, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Oh, hello. Yes, I'd just like to relay a certain episode. I worked for child support for about 16 years in customer service and fielding directly with parents and occasionally with their children. And one particular episode happened around, 15 years ago, so the children must be in their 30s now. And it was a girl that turned out to be about 14 calling with her sister, who was about 12 in the background. And I quickly realized it wasn't parents, and we couldn't talk to them about their case. And the girl mentioned, once I determined she wasn't an adult, she said that she had just gone through visitation with her father, who was self-employed, which is one of the most difficult to collect from. And she said that her mother wasn't helping in the collections at all, and she just wanted to say that the father said that he wasn't paying child support because he didn't think the children were worth it. And the girls, showing their resilience, said that's simply not fair because he doesn't really even know us.
That's great. Good for them.
I certainly hope they lived a good life after that. That's. I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for that comment, Kathy. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a great example of a child having a very sensible and mature response to misbehavior on the part of an adult. And there are some children who are precociously able to look around and to quickly size up adults and say, unfortunately, my parent is not living up to the expectations that one would hope a parent would meet. And I don't admire that, and I will look at other people for role models, and I won't internalize the insult that I perceive from my parent. I'll put it in context and focus on other things, and that's fantastic. Other kids have difficulties understanding hurtful comments like that and need a lot of help in order to feel good about themselves.
What about the idea of guilt during divorce? I've often read or thought I read or remember that kids assume a lot of responsibility for the divorce.
Yeah, that's a good question. The younger a child is, the more they need to see their parents as really very powerful, which makes sense. Think of yourself as like a toddler. You really need that person to be knowledgeable and looking out for you. The older kids are, the more they understand that parents are fallible and they sometimes make poor calls and errors. So younger kids often will tend to feel the most guilt because what they manage to do is instead of saying, my parents are divorcing, it must be their problem, they'll say, my parents are perfect and they're divorcing, it must be my problem. I must have made them fight or I must have done something wrong to create the situation. So the motivation there is to make sure that they perceive that the parent as stable and competent.
Mm-hmm. Got an email that said, could you speak to family events following a divorce, birthdays, holidays, and so forth? I guess they're getting at how do you advise this be handled? How do you address it?
Oh, this is a fascinating thing because a lot of families, especially families who've gone through a contested divorce where they have a court-ordered visitation schedule, will have these holidays that become wretched for the children. And an example is on Christmas Eve, I go to mom's. On Christmas morning, I go to dad's, but I only stay there until after the meal, and then I go back to mom's. And so the kid is going back and forth and back and forth, and they're in constant transition and not able to just relax with their family members. I think sometimes the motivation that parents will present is that they want it to be totally equitable. So they're more focused on having perpetuating a power struggle between the one another than on focusing on how to make a quality and positive experience for their kids. I think that parents need to cooperate and collaborate in their child's best interest and think in the long term what's going to be a positive memory for their kid and plan accordingly. So nobody enjoys a fragmented day on a holiday. That's probably not realistic, but you could think sensibly about alternating holidays or dividing the Christmas break up in half or coming up with practical solutions so people aren't harried and they're able to have pleasure in their new family structure of having two households.
But there are families out there who haven't taken your course and are hardly talking to each other. So how do you make suggestions? Let's assume, and I don't know that about this email, that that's the case. Can you easily, or can you make suggestions on families where the parents are hardly talking to each other about how to handle something like this?
Well, the difficulty in that situation is the lack of communication. And then what ends up happening is that the parents have to focus on what they can control, and they can control the time that they have their child and make that as positive as possible. Unfortunately, many parents will say it's simply impossible for us to communicate and yep. to collaborate with one another. And then the responsibility to negotiate all that conflict falls on the shoulders of a child who has even less mm-hmm. Coping skills for managing this difficult situation.
So who gets hurt the worst in those situations?
Well, I think the children mm-hmm. get.
Julie, I've, in researching this program, I noticed that some judges actually mandate that people going through divorce go through some divorce education.
Well, the state does offer and requires most courts, I think they would say nearly all courts, require parents who are getting divorced to view a video. There's one called Listen to the Children, and that's generally required before a decree will be actually given. Another video that they have is called Two Homes, and that one's only 20 minutes. Those are two things that people can watch. And, you know, as far as whether they're fixing the problem, I haven't or actually been helpful. I haven't yet talked to someone who's viewed that in this situation and heard them say back, wow, that really, you know, I really learned something. The interesting thing is it all seems to people, once you start talking to them, the idea of keeping your child's best interest and your definition, not the courts, we're talking about what your definition of your child's best interest at heart, people, it's common sense. So they think, well, you know, I'm watching this video. I already do that. I already know that. And that's the kind of the question that Kathy and I are raising. If you know that, then keep that as your focus. You're still a family. After you've gotten divorced, you still have these kids, and you have to figure out a way to wage through it. There are other things that the state offers. There's a great website that people should know about if they don't already, and generally I think people do happen upon it when they find themselves in this kind of a situation. It's called the Alaska Family Law Self-Help Center, and that is a resource that's free that was put together by a very smart friend of mine, Catherine Altenator. And it's got a lot of different resources for people. There are classes about if you are representing yourself, how to file. There's actually a class, I think, dedicated court-based procedure for people who are representing themselves in front of the court. And then hearing and trial preparation is another class. The court really wants to be the law, the state. It wants to be accessible, and it's trying to help people find success through this transition point in their life, and so that's what they've put out there.
At your website, the RiptideDivorceEducation.com, there's several books that are recommended reading. Do either one of y'all have one of those? I think that I see six books here that you would absolutely think is important for people to read just to try to think about other resources.
I like this book called Your Divorce Advisor by Diane Mercer and Pruitt. And this book really emphasizes practical strategies for co-parenting. And the other book that I think is super helpful for parents when they're in the throes of divorce is Love and Logic by Jim Fay. And he's a psychologist who has a series of books that are about giving concrete consequences, logical consequences to kids for their positive and negative behaviors. And a lot of parents, when they're in the throes of divorce, find that their kids are amping up their misbehavior, and parents can feel like they're stymied in how to respond. And so here is a great book on how to matter-of-factly respond with productive discipline strategies.
Okay, so useful information that's in a book format. And you can get to those books also from our website, which links to RiptideDivorceEducation.com if you would like. Here's another email. I'm a soon-to-be-divorced mother of a 5-year-old. My spouse refuses to consent to counseling for our son.
Oh, good question.
Our son is showing signs of confusion and emotional distress. What suggestions do you have for me as a parent to help maintain a positive attitude and self-confidence in her son? I've read a few books about divorce and children. I've also seen a therapist in regards to helping me with parenting through this and beyond. My spouse is very negative, she says. I'm afraid that this might be rubbing out or rubbing off on my son.
Okay, this brings up a really big issue that I see a lot in my private practice. When there's a divorce settlement, there's a financial settlement, and then parents have physical custody and legal custody of their child. Now, as you progress on from the divorce, in order for your child to ever receive mental health services from a licensed clinical psychologist, so from a PhD level mental health practitioner, both parents have to consent for treatment. That's considered best practices and the most ethical thing to do. And so women like this, parents like this caller, are stuck if their spouse will not agree or their ex-spouse will not agree for their child to have treatment. Now, oftentimes what parents end up doing is getting a court order. And in my experience, I don't remember ever having someone request a court order who didn't get it. And most of the time, judges would like to see kids have the therapy, and they want kids to be in therapy until they've been discharged by the psychologist or psychotherapist. But it can be very, very difficult if treatment is obstructed. A similar situation occurs with regard to medical care. If, for example, one person is more naturopathic and another person has a Western approach, and there's no agreement, and the child's asthma is uncontrolled, then we have a problem, and that problem can escalate and really approach sort of neglect levels of acuity. So that all loops back to why co-parenting, collaborating, and co-parenting is so critical. In the event that you don't have an ex-spouse who's willing to join in that model, you know, some parents find that they need to seek legal counsel and get a court order.
I guess that kind of gets to the issue of often parents, even during marriage, have completely different frames of references about parenting and healthcare. And when they divorce or are separated, then you or I hear is how things are so different at one house versus the other, which relates to, in my mind, usually just parenting. Sometimes there may be more intentional handling of behaviors differently, but I would think that that's very common and somewhat relates to what you were just saying.
Right, and in the most extreme cases, there can be a custody investigation that results in one person having primary legal and then the other person's ability to affect their child's life is compromised, and that can be a source of distress, of course.
We've got roughly maybe close to 10 minutes or so. If you've got questions or comments about what you're listening to today, why don't you give us a call? We're talking about the effects of divorce on all involved. 550-8433, 1-800 or 1-888, I'm sorry, 353-5752 is our toll-free number. And you can email us at line1@kska.org. What about, I've got a question here about, what about the games that children go through during divorce?
What did the children do or what do the parents do?
Oh, the parents. What I was getting at.
Oh, okay, that's fantastic. Well, a lot of times they'll refuse to communicate whatsoever. They'll say, I'm not going to talk. And this has a huge practical effect on the kids' day-to-day life. So, for example, you want your child to participate in an extracurricular sport. Well, pretty much that's not going to work out if they show up only during your week, but not during your spouse's week. So parents who will not agree on extracurricular activities face a big conflict. Some families will resolve that by saying, okay, I'm going to sign you up for this, and you just do it on my time. And in the abstract, that seems like it would work. In reality, what kids feel like is they feel kind of ashamed and embarrassed when they show up to the sport, and their coaches are frustrated with them, and their teammates think that their participation is dodgy, and they get a lot of negative feedback for what's something that's beyond their control. Clearly, a lot of parents triangulate their kids into their conflicts. You know, your dad is trying to just work me over for more money because he won't get a job. Those kind of comments, that's not good for kids. Many parents confide in kids as if this is a friend, and they overshare information. That's really not age appropriate appropriate and respectful of boundaries. Clearly, many parents have difficulty modeling civility, and if parents feel comfortable being terribly rude and insulting towards one another, it should not be a shock that the child is terribly rude and insulting towards siblings or peers or teachers or parents. And so that there's a logical consequence of observing that behavior. Many parents have a hard time establishing a new routine and schedule, and it's just so chaotic that they're always winging it. And as a result, kids get tired. It's like endless summer. Parents have problems with discipline. Those are typical things.
Another email, it says, do your workshops include conversations with parents who have gone through divorce and have helpful advice from them? I found this to be most helpful when I went through my divorce, and I feel, especially when it comes to putting children first, that it's extremely helpful to have others who've gone through the situation and lived through it to give great advice. So I think what this person's saying is it's kind of like a group therapy thing. It helps to have people there who have experienced similar things, so that they feel not alone in this experience.
Right. Well, that's not something we had considered, but that's certainly a good idea. And maybe something we will incorporate. So thank you.
Yeah, at one time in my practice, we did a lot of group child care. And what was nice about that is I started thinking, well, parenting's like a chronic disease. You know, you got to have a bunch of parents together who get reinforced that you're not the only one up at night, the only one who has trouble with parenting. And hearing other parents' experience kind of puts things in better perspective because you think you're the only one.
Well, we do
out
have
there.
Our classes are for they're small. We're keeping them at 10, partly for that reason. When we are our classes ask people who are going through it currently or are considering going through divorce. Those are who we've considered when we've constructed the curriculum. And the 10 is in an effort to actually have some discussion among participants about their experience.
About their present concerns, and participants are invited to submit issues they like to make sure we address, and we will do that.
So how do parents go about telling children about the divorce?
Well, this is what I recommend. I recommend that parents get together and they come up with a story about the divorce. And the story is basically your explanation of the divorce, and it needs to be a story that's digestible by kids. And it should be agreed upon, and it should emphasize that you made every effort to try to resolve your differences, and that after considerable effort, you've decided that it would be best to divorce. And it can be really hard, Thad, for people to stay kind of on script with the story. And it can be easy to get in little barbs about the other person's inadequacies. But it's really much more helpful for kids if they hear just the same story from their parents about how they've come to the conclusion that they've developed in different directions and they're incompatible. And despite their efforts to stay together, it's not going to work. And there'll be a family in two different households, et cetera. So they should develop a story, agree on the story, and stick to it.
Mm-hmm. And for some kids, they may need reassurance that they'll be taken care of. And, I mean, do you need some assurances in for adolescents that financially maybe it's going to be tough, but we understand that may be a concern? I mean, is it so age-appropriate kind of things would
absolutely
help?
And what will happen is that the kids are going to need reassurances over and over again, mm-hmm. Even as they grow into a new developmental stage. And it's sort of like adoption in this regard. Kids who are adopted have one set of questions when they're five and a different set of questions when they're 15 and a whole different set of questions when they're giving birth themselves. So as with divorce, you can expect that your kids will process this as they grow and present you with new questions.
We only have 3 minutes left, and maybe this is not a fair question to ask at this time, but we've talked about the long-term effects on children. But what about the adults? What about the man and the woman? What do we know about how they respond to adults and how long that lasts? How does it affect subsequent relationships with other men and women, for example?
Well, the effects on adults is significant. Clearly, anyone who's parented knows that parenting alone is much harder than parenting with someone else to help. So it's more work. There's less money. Oftentimes, the adults will think that they're going to lose their negative dynamics, but what they find is that actually they superimpose those dynamics into new relationships, or they seem to fall into the same patterns again. So that's can be a little disappointing. There's less likelihood of a positive outcome in future marriages, and that's discouraging. And there's a higher likelihood of mental health disorders. So the effects on the adult is a lot of discouraging news, And I would say that there's a period of adjustment that can go anywhere from 18 months to 3 years before parents really get comfortable equilibrium and keep moving forward.
Maybe the last question, should all, I was going to say all children, but after the last question, should everyone have some, at least some period of psychological counseling after divorce as well as death and some of these big emotional things in life?
Well, not necessarily. Some people are extremely resilient and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, and the purpose of psychotherapy is really to help people who are need support coping with stressors. So if your child is having difficulty coping or if the parents are having difficulty supporting the child's needs, then that's the appropriate time to contact a psychologist.
Yeah, good point. All right. Last thing I usually ask is what do you want people to remember the most out of the program? Either one of you or both can say something real quickly.
Well, getting divorced carries a threat of really negative consequences for your children, and we hope to prevent that through psychoeducational workshops about the legal and the psychological components involved in divorce and to help you to minimize difficulties as much as possible. And we hope that you'll come to our workshops.
And to get more information, you can come to kska.org/line1 and you get the link to RiptideDivorceEducation.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Kathy Von Hippel and Julie Wrigley have been with us for this very educational hour, and we'll return next week, as you might imagine, and we're going to stay on the mental health issues. We're going to be talking with Mary Kratzky, a documentary filmmaker, and school psychologist Deb Ward. We'll be talking about a film that Mary has produced called About Face, the story of Gwendolyn Bradshaw. And the point of it is to discuss how a mental illness echoes through generations. There's generational effects. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.